Thank you. So I'd like to thank the organizer for the opportunity to give the talk, and as just David announced, I'm going to continue the serial talk we have had yesterday about scattering amplitude, and as you see from the title of my talk, I will be talking mostly about symmetries of scattering amplitudes in maximally supersymmetric gauge theory, and most of my talk is based on the work done in collaboration with James Drummond, Johannes Hahn, Emery Sukachev. So we were talking about scattering amplitude in this particular gauge series. So scattering amplitude, which means that we scatter some states, and in this particular gauge series, asymptotic states just are listed here. So you have two gluon with transverse polarization, and it's convenient to choose to be just helicity plus minus one. You have six scalars with helicity zeros, eight gaugina with helicity plus minus one half. All of the joint representation of gauge series massless particles. And the main question that we'd like to address just is it possible to calculate scattering amplitude, which is defined by on-shell matrix element of the S-matrix with respect to any combination of these asymptotic states? And as you know from the textbooks, that here you have some blob which stands for the S-matrix. If you turn on standard machinery, you could decompose the scattering amplitude in the set of Feynman diagrams. You calculate Feynman diagrams. At the end of the day, what you obtain some expression which will be a non-trivial function with this time invariance and Hoof coupling constants. These quantities will be independent of the gauge, and basically the reason why we are looking for these quantities, which we are hoping to uncover some hidden symmetries of gauge theory by studying these scattering amplitudes. One of the motivations for studying this is, at the end of the day, we would like to learn something about QCD, but this is a long way to go. Another motivation is that there is very strong evidence that scattering amplitude in this particular gauge theory have quite a number of remarkable properties. It has been found by these people that if you start calculating scattering amplitude in this theory perturbatively, there is some remarkable iterative structure which appears at weak coupling. And this iterative structure later led to conjectures about structures of the amplitudes to all loop levels. So one conjecture was by Bernd Dixon Smirnov, a BDS conjecture, which you will see later in my talk. And recently, Aldai Maldacena formulated a proposal how to calculate the same scattering amplitude at strong coupling. So once you have such nice feature appearing both at weak and strong coupling, it's quite natural to expect or put forward a bold conjecture that at the end of the day, given the fact that the series is so symmetric, we are hoping to calculate scattering amplitude exactly for arbitrary value of the Hoof coupling constant. So the final goal of this project would be just to calculate scattering amplitude to start within the planar theory for arbitrary kinematical invariants and for arbitrary values of the Hoof coupling constant. But before describing you how we could approach this goal, let me just summarize you the summary of what we know about general properties of amplitudes in any gauge series. So there is a big difference if you're staying at the level of the trees or the level of the loops. So when you're staying at the level of the trees, basically you're dealing with the classical Lagrangian, which is well defined in four dimensions. There is no any divergences. And therefore, you shouldn't be surprised that any classical symmetries of your series, symmetries of the Lagrangian, should manifest themselves at the level of scattering amplitudes. Another bonus that if you're talking about particular gluon 3 amplitudes, then it could be quite easy to see that gluon 3 amplitudes are the same in any gauge series at real loop level. So in this sense, you could say that studying gluon 3 amplitude in equal force theory, you will describe quite big number of amplitudes in any gauge series. So this situation at real loop levels. So now once you go to the loop level, situation changes dramatically. First of all, you recognize that loop corrections become sensitive to the particle content and therefore they're not universal. They depend on particular Lagrangian. Moreover, you may have ultraviolet divergences, but the nice things about scattering amplitude that ultraviolet divergences will go away as soon as you will express scattering amplitude in terms of Ramelite coupling constant. Well, still, since you're dealing with massless particles, you should be prepared to have infrared singularities. Infrared singularities appear due to the fact that inside the loop you may have propagation of massless particles, soft massless particles, and once you have soft massless particles, normally they induce some infrared singularities. As a consequence, once you have infrared singularities, you're obliged to introduce regularization. And the canonical way to introduce regularization just go to dimensional regularization. And let me emphasize that once you go from four dimensions, let's say to four minus epsilon, you should be prepared to break one number of symmetries. First of all, you should be prepared that any classical symmetry should be broken, like dilatation conformal symmetries. And if there is any other hidden symmetries, you might ask the question, what will happen with those hidden symmetries once you go away from critical dimensions as well? So this brings me to these three questions which I'd like to address in this talk. So the first question would be to identify whether three amplitudes in this series have some hidden symmetry. Once we will identify the symmetry, then we will go to the second question to ask ourselves how powerful are those symmetries to determine the scattering amplitudes. And finally, going to loop levels, given the fact that symmetry will be broken, you should ask yourself that if there is any symmetry, whether you could control the breakdown of those symmetries at real loop level. So these are basically three questions which I'd like to address in this talk. So let me start with some definitions. So we will be talking about the planar limit, and in the planar limit, it's very convenient to decompose scattering amplitude of a very peculiar basis in the color space, which is given by this expression. You have trace of the generators as your gauge group, all in fundamental representations, and indices AN, A1, etc., AN, just color indices of the incoming particles. In this way, you reduce the problem of calculating amplitudes with particular particles incoming and going to the problem of calculating so-called partial amplitudes. And let me emphasize that from now on, I will be dealing with multicolor limit, planar limit. So now, what are these quantities? So these quantities depend on the quantum numbers of the incoming states. And the quantum numbers, these are light-like momenta, helicity, which takes this particular value, and the color. Already, as I mentioned, once you go to the loop, you should be prepared to deal with infrared singularity. Therefore, we'll be introducing dimensional galvanization with epsilon parameter dimensional galvanization, which later will be sent to zero. So now, the next step, let's think about this object and let's try to classify these partial amplitudes as a function of total helicity. So you have n particles with helicity h1, etc., hn, and then you could look for the total helicity. Then it's quite easy to see that the total helicity takes this value. So it starts from n, maximum value, n number of particles, and then goes by step 2 up to the values minus n. So now if you look for these values and you look for the values maximal next to maximal and similarly for minimal next to minimal, then you could show that thanks to the supersymmetry, the corresponding amplitude vanish to all loop levels. So these are zeros to all loop levels. The first amplitude which is different from zero is the one for which helicity, total helicity is n minus 4. These amplitudes are called MHV amplitudes, and here I just give you two examples. Imagine having amplitudes with two gluons with helicity minus and all other gluons helicity plus. So this is just a typical example of MHV amplitudes. These amplitudes also are known to have quite remarkable properties. Namely, if you calculate perturbative correction to MHV amplitudes to loop level, thanks to supersymmetry, you could show that all perturbative corrections could be factored out into single scalar function. Doesn't matter in which order you have plus minus sitting here in the helicity assignment, perturbative corrections are described by the same universal function. This function depends on its time invariance of the coupling constant. And basically, this remarkable feature already suggests you that MHV amplitude should be special. And indeed, you will see they are indeed special. So then you could go on, and for example, you could decrease total helicity. And the first example, for example, you may have amplitude with three gluon helicity minus all pluses. These are called next to MHV amplitudes. And it's also known that once you start talking about such amplitudes, you will see much more possible amplitudes to appear, which have much more complicated structure compared to MHV amplitudes. So it's next to mass. So at that moment, what you do, you're just saying, okay, let me use supersymmetry to simplify the structure of the amplitudes. And so what you do, you just reorganize the amplitude into super amplitudes. So the natural framework for doing so was proposed long ago by Maldestam, Brink et al., which has to do with so-called light cone superspace approach. So again, I list here asymptotic states. You have gluons, helicity plus minus one, gluinos, and scalars. And then the remarkable observation of these people was that they could combine all these asymptotic states into single superstates. To this end, you introduce some additional auxiliary Grassmann variables eta, which carries SU4 index, and then you just write general expansion of some superstates over powers of the etas. The lowest components define your gluon with helicity plus one, and then you go down up to you go to the terms force power etas with corresponding coefficient being gluon helicity minus one. So this becomes a single CPT conjugated superstate, which you could use to describe all possible amplitudes in this theory. For example, if you want to look for the MHV amplitudes, what you have to do, you just have to look for the expansion of super amplitudes in powers of eta with total power equal to 8. So for example, if you have terms eta 1 power 4, eta 2 power 4, then you ensure the corresponding amplitude will have two gluons with indices 1 and 2 helicity minus 1 and all other helicity plus 1. So this becomes a very economical way how you could encode various amplitudes into a single object, which is super amplitudes. So the next step, what you do, you want to get rid from the constraint of the momenta. So all momenta of particles are light-like, and then it's very convenient to resolve this condition by introducing a pair of two commuting spinners, which here denoted lambda and lambda tilde. I correspond to the number of the particles, alpha, alpha dot, these are two-dimensional indices. And then this lambda, lambda bar could be thought as a wave function of fermions carrying helicity plus minus one-half. And then finally, what I'd like to do, I'd like to use some kind of the shorthand notation introducing lambda for the breadth vectors and lambda bar for the ket vectors. So later you will see in my talk these notations intensively. So finally, once you introduce this setup, the goal is just to calculate super amplitude for the scattering of these superstates with indices 1 to n as a function of here quantum numbers. And now quantum numbers will be lambda, lambda bar for each particles, which stands for the momenta and corresponding eta variable. So the goal is just to find this object. So let's start from the three amplitudes. And among three amplitudes, let me choose the simplest one which doesn't vanish. And I told you this is just MHV amplitudes. So the first remarkable feature which you observe is that if you sum all possible MHV amplitudes combined to single object superamplitude, you will find that the result is looks remarkably simple. So this becomes a single superamplitude which encodes information about all MHV amplitudes in your theory. So in numerator, you have product of two delta functions. The first delta function is trivial, it just ensures conservation of total momenta. And second delta function is special. Actually, it's this delta function that ensures on-shell supersymmetry. So on-shell supersymmetry in this case is just defined by these two generators, Q and Q-bar, given this form, and then it becomes straightforward to verify that both generators annihilate this amplitude. So this amplitude is explicitly consistent with on-shell and equal 4 supersymmetry. Notice that here in the denominator you have this angular bracket, and this angular bracket stands for the contraction of corresponding holomorphic spinners with 1 and 2 corresponding to particle number 1 and 2, etc., etc. Then I said, remember I told you that if you're staying at the level of the trees, you're expecting that all classical symmetries of the Lagrangian should be present at the level of the amplitudes. And since we know that n equal 4 theory is superconformal invariance, the next step to do is to verify whether it possesses this symmetry. For example, the first step to do is just taking conformal boost generator. So this generator K, which is given by second order differential operator, then it becomes non-trivial to verify that this amplitude did annihilated by the generators, it becomes even less non-trivial to go to next MHV and to verify this relation. But actually, as we thought yesterday, the situation is a bit more complicated. If you just do this honest calculation by applying this K to the amplitudes, you will realize that due to the fact that here you have angular bracket denominator, which have singularities when momenta particles 1 and 2 becomes aligned, actually the symmetry is not exact. Due to so-called holomorphic anomaly, for example, if you apply S-bar superconformal generator to the MHV amplitude, you could show that the result of this calculation gives rise to expression which involves two delta functions, which tell you that momenta particles I and I plus 1 align times amplitude which has one number particle less. So from this, you could say that this superconformal symmetry of the amplitudes at three levels is almost exact. And almost stands for this contribution, which are localized on very peculiar configurations, which have external momenta aligned. And we will come to this at the end of my talk. So once you verify conventional superconformal symmetry of three amplitudes, then you ask the next question, whether there's any hidden symmetry in these amplitudes. And indeed, the answer is yes. It turned out that these three amplitudes have the additional hidden symmetry, and this hidden symmetry goes under the name of dual superconformal symmetry. So the way how you could think about this dual superconformal symmetry is the following one. So imagine you have the amplitude with external particles 1, etc., n. And then what you'd like to do, you'd like to resolve explicitly the constraints which are imposed by total momentum conservation as well as total supercharge equal to 0. Then it's quite easy to see that if you're replacing momenta of particles I as a difference of two dual coordinates xi, x plus 1, then this condition will automatically satisfy it if you impose periodicity conditions on the x variables. In very much the same manner, if you want to ensure the total supercharge vanishes, it's just sufficient just to take the product of the lambda times the eta and write as a difference the corresponding variables. And since eta is Grassmann variables, theta has also become Grassmann variables. Moreover, theta carries both SU4 index and SU2 index of spinners. So once you introduce these dual variables, you could immediately rewrite MHV superamplitude in this simple form. So what you have here, instead of two delta functions which involved the sum of various momenta and supercharges, you just have these periodicity conditions which are enforced by the delta function. And then it becomes straightforward to verify that since you have here difference of two thetas, this expression is explicitly invariant on the shifts in thetas. It's also invariant on the shifts of axis and as well as shift of axis proportional to thetas. So this becomes three obvious symmetries which you could easily verify just looking at these amplitudes. And these three generators form Poincaré supersymmetry, which is dual to Poincaré supersymmetry, which is expressed by this relation. So now let's do one step forward and ask ourselves whether this Poincaré supersymmetry could be promoted superconformal symmetry. To this, you have to add inversion. So I already mentioned to you these lambdas have a meaning of wave function of fermions with particular helicity. Now what happens is dual coordinates, you treat axes as being normal coordinates. You remember these axes were defined from the very beginning through the momenta. Therefore, by definition, the momenta. But now what I want to do, I want to define the transformation which acts on the momenta as if they were coordinates. So therefore, I'm just transforming lambda as if they were wave function configuration spaces with some matrix correspondingly for the thetas. And then it becomes straightforward to verify that with these transformation properties, angular bracket with particle i plus 1 transforms covariantly, as well as the delta function, which were in numerator, also transforms covariantly in such a way that the whole superamplitude also transforms covariantly. So this becomes very non-trivial property of the superamplitude under dual conformal transformations. Let me remind you that we are dealing with MHV amplitudes. Then it turned out that this property is universal property of all superamplitudes. So if you go from MHV to next MHV, et cetera, then the statement is this becomes the universal feature of all superamplitudes in this gauge theory. So all three superamplitudes have very nice transformation properties under dual superconformal transformations. So now once we have conventional conformal symmetry, dual superconformal symmetry, the question immediately arises how the symmetry coexists. And here you have a picture which shows you how these symmetries coexist. So what you have here on both circles is a pictorial representation for two superconformal symmetries, SU2/4. On the left hand side, it's just conventional superconformal symmetry with Poincaré generator standing here, superconformal generator standing over there. And what you have here on the right is a new hidden symmetry, this dual superconformal symmetry. So these two symmetries share common generators, but aside from these generators, this one are different. Quite remarkably, these symmetries which I described before were identified first at the level of three amplitudes also appear strong coupling in the DS5 process 5 background. Namely, as was shown by these people, a DS sigma model in DS5 process 5 background has a remarkable symmetry under combined bosonic and fermionic duality, and this invariance naturally gives rise to more or less the same picture for the symmetries. So the next step, then you verify how these algebras coexist. And the, even though they share two generators, you could easily verify that these remaining generators do not commute. So then the next step, you just look for the closure of these two algebras, and then, as was shown by these people, and I'm sure you will hear the next talk, that infinite dimensional closure of these two symmetries turned out to have Youngian structure. So this becomes sort of very detailed information about symmetries of three-level amplitudes, and then the next step, you have to do the calculation. And actually, again, it was shown by these people that you could turn on machinery of an equal force theory based on so-called BCFW recursion relations and calculate basically all three-loop amplitudes in this theory. So at this stage, you could conclude that at three-loop level, we know more or less everything about an equal force theory. We know all symmetries of three-loop amplitudes. But now I want to ask sort of different questions. Instead of looking for the explicit expression, I want to ask the question, how powerful are the symmetries? So we have these two nice symmetries. We know a lot about them. But now let's ask the question, how powerful are the symmetry to determine three-level amplitudes? Just let's do just backwards. And to approach this question, it's convenient to introduce so-called ratio function. So imagine I have these superamplitudes, which describe all possible amplitudes, MHV, next MHV, etc. This is just whole object which knows about all amplitudes in my theory. And then what I would like to do, I'd like to divide this three-level superamplitude by particular MHV superamplitude you have seen previously. Since both superamplitudes involve some Grassmannian delta function, it's not a smart idea to divide them, but instead of this, you're just writing one of them as a product of MHV superamplitude times another function, Rn. which we'll call ratio function. So this ratio function naturally will have expansion, which will involve MHV terms, next to MHV, et cetera, and then since superamplitudes and MHV superamplitudes have the same weights under both transformations, it's quite natural to expect that this ratio function should be invariant under both symmetries. So in this way, we reduce the problem of calculating the amplitude to the problem of finding some function which respects both symmetries simultaneously. So this letter, small g, I denote conventional superconformal generators, and capital G is dual superconformal generators. So now the question how symmetries determine this ratio function is just the question how to find solution to this system's equation. So what we'd like to do, we'd like to require the generators of conventional and dual superconformal symmetry should angulate this function. And additional information about this P that we're dealing with next to next to MHV amplitude, that this function by definition should be polynomial, homogeneous polynomial in Grassmann variables of degree which are dictated by how far from MHV level. So let me emphasize that this system's equation is well defined, but its general solution has not been found so far. So we have some limited information about the solution, and let me describe this limited information. First of all, you start from p equal to 0. P equal to 0, it means that we're dealing with MHV superamplitude. Then it becomes straightforward to show that the only solution to this system's equation is that this ratio function will be just a constant. Constant which doesn't depend on neither momentum nor on dual coordinates. So in this case, you could say that these two symmetries together uniquely fixed this ratio function up to normalization. The first non-trivial example appears when you go to p equal to 1, and this corresponds to next to MHV amplitude. So in this case, it turned out that this system of the equation has very non-trivial solution. And this very non-trivial solution is shown in this formula. So this solution are parameterized by three indices, which whose meaning I will just give you in a second, just R, S, and T, so just integer numbers. The arguments are just dual variables, x, lambda, and theta, and here you have this sort of length expression. So notice that theta appears here inside the argument of delta function, and this delta function Grassmannian. So the fact that it's Grassmannian means that here we're dealing with a homogeneous polynomial in eta of degree 4 with very peculiar coefficients which are defined by the lambdas and x's. And then you have this denominator which involves five factors, which I will come to later in a second. So the reason why I put this RST is a very profound one, because actually you could associate with this object, with this expression, very peculiar Feynman diagram. And this Feynman diagram has the form of scalar box with one leg massless and three legs massive. So actually this diagram first appeared in paper by these people and actually has to do with so-called three mass box coefficients. You could see that these are three mass box diagrams and all corners of this diagram are defined by indices R, S, and T, which P is the argument of this invariant. So it's very convenient to have in mind these pictorial presentations because there is one-to-one correspondence how out of these diagrams you could write this length expression. So now once we identify these invariants, what we do next? So once you know that you defined, satisfy this equation, that you got quite a number of invariants, the next step to do is just write the general solution to these equations is a linear combination of the invariants. And since we have quite a number of those invariants, the general solution will be given by this sum with some weights, some numbers, coefficients C, R, S, and T, which is arbitrary. And then let me emphasize that it doesn't matter which coefficient you put here, for arbitrary C, this equation will be always satisfied. So another way, at this level, we just used maximal from the supersymmetry. So we imposed the condition of both supersymmetries to fix R's, but both supersymmetry will never tell you what C stands for. So this level, you conclude that the combined action of conventional dual superconformal symmetry is not sufficient to fix those coefficients. There should be something more that you have to provide to fix these coefficients. So this additional information comes from study of analytical properties of the amplitudes. So let me remind you that three-level amplitudes are meromorphic function of kinematical invariants. Moreover, we know that the position of singularity is just simple pole located at values corresponding to vanishing of Mollier particle invariant state. So you take color-ordered amplitudes, and then you take invariant mass of the adjacent particles with indices from S to T minus 1, and this will be just the pole which you're supposed to encounter into scattering amplitudes. These are called physical poles. At the same time, it's known that if you're just doing different approach to calculate scattering amplitudes, so-called spurious singularities appear as intermediate steps. They appear at intermediate steps, but they cancel the final expressions. Let's now try to verify whether our R invariants have spurious singularities. And this may remind you that in previous slides, you have seen the expression for this RN variant, which had five-factor denominator. So these are those factors. So you have one factor which exactly matches into these invariant masses, and there is four another factors which looks like matrix element between two lambda spinners of product of matrices which defy by the momenta. Total four factors. What was the What was the statement in the... There's two things. Let me ask Matthias the question, then I probably will correct. What we heard yesterday is that if you start from conventional representation of superconformal symmetry, then conventional representation of superconformal symmetry doesn't fix your nucleus amplitude. You will fix your nucleus amplitude if you will require that you know how to modify a generator such a way to remove certain singularities.
So what do you mean by conventional?
Conventional, I mean the representation. You start from the Lagrangian. You define neuter currents. Neuter currents give rise to certain operators which you realize the Lyapunov amplitude is a differential operator acting on the amplitudes. So those differential operators define your conventional representation of superconformal symmetry. If you require now that the amplitude are invariant and the conventional supersymmetry defined this way, scattering amplitudes are not fixed uniquely.
That is true. I mean, but the only question is why do you insist on looking at the conventional, which is the free action of the symmetry generator? If you're in an interacting field before.
Wait a second. Next transparency. Another way, if I'm naively simple-minded person and I have only classical symmetry dictated by my Lagrangian, this is what happens. Now the question is whether I have to deform generator or not, we could discuss in the next slide. But at this stage, if I just look at for the symmetry dictated by my Lagrangian, this is just a statement that you have ambiguity at the level of these coefficients. None of the symmetry doesn't fix these coefficients. And now what I want to show you is that if you look for these RN variants and you look particularly for this denominator for factors shown in blue, these are spurious poles. Why are spurious poles? So let's look, for example, for this factor here. So it has matrix element between R and T. These are two spinners, holomorphic spinners of product two axes. So now you take modulo square of this object, and then you could easily show that this condition translates into very special conditions on those variable X square. And to remind you, this X square is just invariant masses of the particles. So this particular spurious poles translates into this condition which defined your sort of hypersurface in the abstract phase space of all possible this time invariants. Instead of having pole localized at the point, you have a pole localized on the surface. And you don't want to have this pole. So you have to cancel this pole because these poles are non-physical. So how to cancel these poles? First of all, okay, to make the situation even worse, so you have four sequences of these poles. I just took only one here, but you see they have four different configurations. So now you have to require that all of these poles, each of them separately, should go away. So how could it happen? It happened because there is some what we call magic identity between these R invariants. And turned out that if you're looking for the spurious poles of this particular invariant, you could show that if you add to this invariant this particular contribution, sum into differences, that in this sum, all spurious poles of this guy goes away. So once you know this property, it becomes more straightforward to give a recipe how to verify cancellation of spurious poles. So just look for the general expression with coefficients you have seen before, and now what you have to ensure that each of these R invariants appears with very peculiar combination by dictated by this formula. Let me show how it works by choosing the case of n equal 8 NMHV amplitudes. So let me emphasize that if you look for these amplitudes in the component, let's say take gluon amplitudes, you will get quite a number of terms. Not even 21 terms we had yesterday, but quite a bigger number of terms. The power of supersymmetry, conventional and normal superconformal symmetry, that if you're using these two symmetries simultaneously, that these few dozen terms are written as a single line. So this single line describes all possible eight particles next to Machiavelli amplitude in your theory. The only drawback of this formula that you have alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and epsilon, just arbitrary coefficient. Again, I told you, supersymmetry doesn't fix you this coefficient, just arbitrary numbers. For arbitrary values, alpha, beta, et cetera, the expression respects both symmetries. But now we require that spurious poles should cancel and apply this identity. This immediately gives you five relations. These are five relations, homogeneous equations from the coefficients. And then you could show immediately that these equations, actually there is more of them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six equations for five coefficients. So the system is overdetermined, but you could verify that it has a unique solution. Up to overnormalization, it has this solution. So for 8-point amplitudes, you could verify using the setup that there is a solution for which spurious poles cancel. So now you go to another condition, and this will be a condition which was mentioned yesterday by Tristan, which has to do with so-called collinear limits. So now if you really want to take care of those collinear singularities, you know that in the collinear limit, amplitude has very peculiar behavior. It's translated into ratio function, basically means that you have particles indices i plus 1, and they become aligned in superspace. Now this ratio function, this collinear limit, will reduce to the ratio function with one particle less, and the corresponding supermomentum being by the sum of two momenta. Then you could impose this condition at the level of the expression, and then you will find that exactly the same equations are satisfied. Moreover, alpha turned out to be equal to 1/8. So either the cancellation of spurious poles or collinear behavior give you the same expression for these ratio functions with alpha, beta, et cetera, fixed uniquely. In this way, you conclude that three-level amplitudes with all symmetry encoded plus analytic conditions are fixed uniquely. Yes. What we heard yesterday, the way how you modify generator, the talk which you heard yesterday, it was a talk where you tried to deform generators. How you try to deform generators? The way how you deform generators just automatically satisfies these conditions. So the way how you deform generators, you require that new deformed generators should automatically satisfy these conditions. And therefore, the formation of generators which was presented yesterday is equivalent to the imposing the condition of the collinear behavior. But this, I want to find, this is the additional condition which you impose by hand at top of all symmetries. So this was the end of the story for the three amplitudes. Now I want to go to loops. So again, for trees, we've seen there was a lot of nice symmetries. We explored as much as possible from the symmetries, and now we go to loops. And I told you at the very beginning that once you go to loops, you should be ready to have all symmetries broken by singularities. And indeed, loop correction being you infer singularities, you're obliged to go away from the critical dimensions, you lose all conformal symmetries. Well, still, we know quite a lot of things about amplitude at loop level. First of all, it's known back to 20 years old papers in QCD that if you sum all infrared singularities, then it could show that all loop amplitudes calculated in for theory could be split into product of two factors. One of the factors will carry infrared singularities, and there will be some finite remainder. Moreover, this divergent factor has very peculiar form. And then for C is simply given by the exponent of the sum of two contributions, one of them containing double pole and single pole. So the corresponding residue quite special. These are some numbers. So the number in front of the leading pole, double pole, it's known as the Casper normalized dimensions of Wilson loop. And actually, it becomes very non-trivial statement that these leading infrared singularities turned out to be intrinsically related to ultraviolet singularities of the Capst Wilson loop. Subleading poles are described by another set of the coefficients which go under the name of the collinear normalized dimension. So this collinear normalized dimension is scheme-dependent, is not as nice as the Casper normalized dimension. So once you have these ansatz, it becomes one-line exercise to verify that if you just take start with conformal generators and to apply it to this amplitude, you immediately find that this divergent factor will break all possible conformal symmetries. So if you introduce smart regularization which preserves supersymmetry, you have to deal with breaking of conformal or superconformal symmetries, but still Poincaré supersymmetry is intact. So why this breaking is so nasty? The breaking is so nasty because it's induced by infrared singularities. I told you infrared singularities come from soft gluon momenta. So you're dealing with the particles which propagate long distances. And once you propagate long distances, it's quite natural to expect that corresponding anomalies are not localized. They don't come from short distances. They actually come from all possible distances. And so far, the only experience which we have with the controlling anomaly, let's say, in gauge series, these were anomalies which come from short distances. So now we'd have to deal with the questions how to control breaking of the anomalies which come from large distances. But before I will explain you how we do so, let me sort of give you some summary of what happens with the symmetries. So you saw already this cartoon before. What you have here on the left, this is a conventional superconformal symmetry. Here you have dual superconformal symmetry, and now you introduce inference singularities. Inference singularities break part of the symmetries. So Poincaré supersymmetry is intact, what's shown here in black. Since you have identification generators, then conformal, superconformal S-bar symmetry dual is also intact. But what happens is that superconformal symmetry in conventional is broken, as well as conformal boost superconformal transformations and Kubar supersymmetry is also broken. So what happens at the level of the conformal symmetry? You have only P, Q, and Kubar symmetries intact. But at the level of the dual, you have P, Q, and S-bar intact, unbroken. So then you have a commutation relation basically tells you that out of the six anomalies, only three are independent. And it's convenient to show the three independent anomalies being S, these conventional superconformal generators, Kubar, this is a dual Poincaré generators, and K, this is just conformal boost in the dual variables. So now the question is, if you want to make some progress, we have to be able to control at least part of these anomalies. And then there's quite a nice thing about this K anomaly, again, this K anomaly which perform conformal boost in the dual variables. It turns out that this anomaly is universal. In other way, it has the same form, doesn't matter whether you're dealing with MHV, next MHV, et cetera, et cetera. Just universal anomaly. If you know this anomaly for MHV amplitudes, you know its answer for all amplitudes. So now, how we determine this anomaly? Since it's universal, we go to MHV amplitudes. And then for MHV amplitudes, there is another remarkable feature, which goes under the name of the Wilson loop MHV amplitude duality. So this duality allows us to find this anomaly. And I will show you in a second how we do so. But as it's Kubar anomalies, these two anomalies are very hard. And I will tell you later at the end of my talk how we do it, what we do with this anomaly. So now let me explain you what this duality all about. So I'll emphasize that this duality holds only for MHV amplitudes, and the statement that this duality holds for planar amplitudes to all loop level. So what you have here on the left-hand side is just cartoon which depicts MHV amplitude with n particles, momenta p1, et cetera, pn. What you have here on the right, this is an integration contour shown by the double line, and here you have a Wilson loop. So this is a Wilson loop calculated in configuration space or very special contour, which is a polygon. And then what you do, you establish a correspondence between these two different objects. So this object lives in configuration space. This object lives in momentum space. And the relation between these two pictures is established after you identify, for example, momenta p1 with a segment connecting points x1 and x2. So this contour intrinsically built out of the momenta of the particles which appear at the amplitude. And then the statement is that for arbitrary value of the coupling constant, logarithms of these amplitudes is proportional. All perturbative corrections to these objects are described by the logarithms of this Wilson loop. So what's the status of this conjecture? First of all, this conjecture has been proposed first as strong coupling, and it reproduced BDS ansatz. And later, it was also verified at weak coupling. At weak coupling, up to now, we have very solid argument that it should hold to two loops. So this conjecture was verified to two loops for arbitrary number of external legs by these groups. And the result was the following, that if you calculate this Wilson loop to two loops for arbitrary number of n, you will find that BDS ansatz using this relation is produced for 4 to 5 points, but starting from 6, this relation is not true. In other way, BDS ansatz is a contradiction with the Wilson loop. Finally, the last remark that this duality is supposed to work in n equal 4 theory for arbitrary value of Mandelstam invariance, but it's quite interesting to note that the same duality holds in QCD, but only in the radial limit. So finally, I come to the question, how do we control anomaly? So let me start again from this K anomaly, and I remind you this anomaly is universal. So it's since universal, I'm dealing with the MHV amplitude. So for MHV amplitude, we have seen that they have this dual conformal symmetry. But now, through this duality relation, I could map dual conformal symmetry of the amplitudes into conventional conformal symmetry of the Wilson loop in configuration space. So it's just one-to-one correspondence. And when it's so, then dual conformal anomaly at the level of amplitude is naturally mapped into conventional conformal anomaly of the Wilson loop. And the next step, you ask yourself, how it could be that the Wilson loop and n equal 4 theory have conformal anomaly? And the answer is the following. So if the Wilson loop were well-defined strictly in four dimensions, then it's more or less obvious that conformal symmetry were exact. In other words, it's sufficient that you perform conformal transformation integration contour, Wilson loop up. Sorry. Wilson loop should be the same. But now you remember that the Wilson loop I'm dealing with has cusps. And moreover, these cusps are formed by the vector with a light-like vector. These two things together induce some additional singularities. These are so-called cusp singularities. The fact that Wilson loop has cusp singularities automatically implies that it's anomalous. And therefore, it requires regularization. So again, at the moment you introduce regularization going from 4 to 4 minus epsilon dimensions, you break a formality. And then when you reduce, when you remove regularization, the price to pay that you end up with cusp anomaly. So the presence of the cusps in the Gaussian contour brings you this cusp anomaly. And once you know cusp anomaly, you control breaking of the conformal symmetry for the Wilson loops, which through these relations amounts to the controlling a dual conformal anomaly of the scattering amplitude. To make the long story short, here's just the relation. So after you go into standard analysis, you could show that conformal wet identities gives rise to these relations, which basically tells you how this dual conformal operators acts on the finite part of the scattering amplitude. And it's not surprising that it's proportional to the cusp anomaly. If there were no cusp anomaly, the symmetry were exact. So the cusp anomalous dimension appears as a prefactor. But what's remarkable is that the function which stands in front of cusp anomalous dimension doesn't depend on the coupling, and therefore it's basically dictated by one loop calculation. It's a very, very well-defined function of the dual variables, and once you don't know the variables, you know this anomaly to all loop level. So now, once we know this dual conformal anomaly, the next question, could we make use of this anomaly? And then it turned out that this anomaly becomes quite powerful if the number of points equal to 4 and to 5. The reason for that is that if you have 4 and 4 pi points on your Wilson loop, that you could easily show that there is no conformal ratios you could construct out of 4 or 5 points, which means that this conformal symmetry will uniquely define you the function. And indeed, if you solve this word identity you have seen before for 4 and 5 points, this becomes the unique solution modulo additive constant. And now if you translate these x's into corresponding Mandelstam variables, you will find that these expressions are exactly coincide with BDS and that's for 4 and 5 point amplitudes. However, if you go to 6 points, then situation becomes more complicated because in this case you encounter conformal ratios, and when you have conformal ratios, there is no way how conformal symmetry will dictate your corresponding function. And therefore, at this stage, you could start to worry whether this duality you have seen before works or doesn't work for the amplitude. At this stage, two parallel calculations have been done. One of them was for the amplitudes, 6-point amplitudes to the loop. Another was corresponding 6-point Wilson loop to the loops. And then both calculations gave rise to this finite part of the amplitude, finite part of the Wilson loop. And then comparison have shown that both of them deviate from BDS and that, but they agree with each other, which give you some solid argument that indeed this duality holds at least for 6-pointed two loops. And going backward, you could say that the same relation tells you that we do have good control on the dual conformal anomaly of the amplitude. Numerically, yes, thank you. So this relation, up to now, the corresponding function deviation between 6-point amplitude Wilson loop and this BDS and that is known in the form of some numerical code, which are composed by some finite number of Feynman integrals, but analytical expression is not known yet for general kinematics. So now, once we sort of understood how things go for MHV, and we know this K anomaly, which again is universal in the same for all amplitudes, now let's go beyond MHV. So once we go beyond MHV, the first things to examine next to MHV superamplitudes. So this next to MHV superamplitude supposed to describe all possible next to MHV amplitudes, and among them there is gluon amplitudes. So for poor gluon amplitudes, we used results obtained by these people to translate all possible gluon amplitudes into single object which are next to MHV superamplitudes. And this next to MHV superamplitude has this the following form. So again, the way how you represent the result, you write n MHV superamplitude to one loop level in the factorized form. So you factor out MHV amplitudes, about which you know almost everything, times some function, which is sort of ratio function with perturbative correction included. I told you already that the amplitudes, this amplitude and this amplitude have infrared singularities. And those infrared singularities were responsible for breaking of symmetries. But now we know that infrared singularities of this amplitude are the same. Therefore, if you divide this amplitude by that one, you have to conclude that this function R as free is free from infrared singularities. So at the moment, you cancel infrared singularities, you got some hope that more probably after singularities go away, you will have some restoration of some symmetries. And indeed, what happens that if you look carefully to expression for this function, one-loop expression, you will find that it has this remarkable form. Namely, it's given by the sum, where sum runs over those R invariants we have seen at the tree level. The only difference with respect to tree level is that those C coefficients we have seen before now transformed into a function of Mandelstam invariants. In this way, what we obtain is that this one-loop ratio function, it decomposes of the superconformal invariants with some coefficients which turned out to be dual conformal invariant. So now you have dual conformal invariant at the level of this function and dual superconformal invariant at the level of R function. And then the first question you have to ask, how it possible that you, at the region, originally you didn't expect to have any symmetry, but now you have a lot of symmetry. But why superconformal symmetry of this guy got reduced to conformal symmetry of V? What happens with superconformal symmetry of V? Why it's broken? And the answer was it's broken because there's another anomaly, and this is a so-called Kubar anomaly. You remember, I told you already about Kubar anomaly. So now let's try to calculate this Kubar anomaly. I told you this Kubar anomaly is not universal, therefore you should be prepared to suffer. But to make your suffering less, it's restrict. Instead of calculating this anomaly directly, let's try discontinuity. We'll calculate discontinuity of this object with respect to some kinematical invariance. So what we do, we just take this, for example, six-point MHV amplitude, and we take discontinuity with respect to three-particle invariant mass. Then you use an iterative relation to show that this discontinuity of one-loop amplitude is given by the product of two MHV amplitudes, three-level amplitudes, integrated with the phase space of two particles. L1 and L2 stands for the particles which go through the unitary cut. And then if you want to calculate the anomaly, what you do, you vary both sides of these relations with respect to Kubar symmetry. And then since Kubar is differential operator of the first order, it's quite natural that variation of the product or convolution of two functions is given by the two terms where you have convolution of first amplitude, convolution of second one. So now, if Kubar symmetry of the MHV amplitude were exact, it would be zero. But you remember from the very beginning of my talk, I mentioned to you that due to holomorphic anomaly, this guy is different from zero. Moreover, it's localized on very peculiar collinear configurations. These two things together immediately tells you could calculate this convolution with no integration. It's just one line calculation. And after you do similar calculation for next two MHV amplitudes, you take the ratio and here's the result. So the result is the following. The discontinuity of this six-point next to MHV amplitude ratio functions with Kubar symmetry is just given by this expression. But what's important, don't pay attention to how complicated it is. It's different from zero. So this, since discontinuity of this object is different from zero, it means that Kubar on the function is also different from zero. So from which we conclude that Kubar anomaly, dual Kubar anomaly of this ratio function is different from zero thanks to the holomorphic anomaly. So the holomorphic anomaly breaks dual supersymmetry, but doesn't affect dual conformal symmetry. So once you have all the things together, now comes the proposal. So now what we'd like to do, we'd like to formulate the proposal for all superamplitudes in n equal 4 series to all loops. So this all loop superamplitudes is given by the sum of MHV and XMHV, et cetera, just this general expression. So what do we know? We know that at real level, these superamplitudes respect both symmetry. Moreover, if you impose analytic conditions, you could deconstruct it analytically. At loop level, symmetries are broken both by singularities and holomorphic anomaly. But then it turned out that if you write these expressions in factorized form by pulling out all loop MHV amplitudes and you consider this ratio function, the conjecture is that this ratio function will be dual conformal invariants to all loops. So as it stands today, this conjecture has been proven at one loop level. So finally, this brings me to the conclusion to the open question. So I try to argue that the three-level amplitude in this theory, n equal 4 theory, have quite a nice symmetries, conventional dual superconformal symmetries, but these symmetries alone are not sufficient to constrain even three-level amplitudes. You need some additional information. Additional information comes from the analyticity conditions. So once you go to loop level, symmetries are broken, and we identify two different sources of breaking of the symmetries, so the infrared singularities and holomorphic anomaly. Dual conformal anomaly we control using Wilson loop duality. But now the question is how to control the remaining duality, the remaining anomalies. So to control the remaining anomalies, we need analogs of Wilson lines, Wilson loops for this superamplitude. So I put here question marks to indicate that we don't really understand what object stands here. Moreover, if it exists, it should be quite unusual. Why? Because these dual objects should have Kubar anomaly. And Kubar anomaly just normal Poincaré supersymmetry. Another way, if this object admits dual description, the dual model should not respect supersymmetry. And this is difficult to understand. Finally, there is another paradox, which I formulated as a weak strong coupling paradox. So I told you that if you calculate Kubar anomaly of the amplitudes of the ratio function, then you will see that modulo holomorphic anomaly, the trivial expression starts from one loop. So you have one loop contribution, two loop contributions, and in principle you should expect that at any order in Hoof Kubrick expansion, you will have some perturbative corrections. So this Kubar anomaly is just different from zero for the trivial of the coupling constant. But now what happened to strong coupling? If you go to strong coupling and you use Aldai-Maldacena prescription for calculating, for example, next to power p MHV amplitudes, the prescription tells you it's just given by the universal factor times some corrections which go into inverse power of the square root of the Hoof coupling. The fact that it's universal, it means that it doesn't matter whether it's MHV or next to MHV, whatever, expressions are always the same. Which basically tells you that if you calculate corresponding R function, ratio function, using this prediction, you will find that it will be always given by the three-level expression plus strong coupling corrections. But three-level expression does verify Kubar symmetry. So how could it be that any order in the coupling expansion, Kubar anomaly is different from zero, but once you go to strong coupling, it goes away? Number one. And second, since we know the holomorphic anomaly is part of the whole picture, what does it mean, a string theory? What will be the meaning of holomorphic anomaly of string theory? So this is a question which I leave open. Thank you very much.
Matthias. I just looked up again Tristan's talk from yesterday, and it seems like your first point is really completely in contradiction to what was the message of his talk.
Say again, please.
I mean, my understanding was it's as much a question to what they did, but it seems like the message there were, if you really look correctly at the interacting generators, and that's what you should do in an interacting theory, of course, you shouldn't restrict your generators to tree level, then indeed symmetry fixes the tree level amplitude. That's at least what I understood.
There's one thing which is confusing. I think I already had discussion. Let's compare two different descriptions. You have intuition coming from dilatation operator, right? We know the dilatation operator receives perturbative corrections, we start including corrections. Here we're talking about, imagine we're talking about dilatation operator in this context, right? Dilatation operator has two representations. One is, you know, the dilatation operator is given by the integral of the certain component of tensor energy momentum, right? It's quantum field operators which acts on your object, in this case, amplitude. And this operator indeed receives perturbative corrections. But then you ask yourself, what is the representation of this operator? Well, for example, the correlation function. And you know that the representation of the correlation function, it doesn't depend on the coupling constant. It is x d over dx. It's not modified. It's just x d over dx. What modifies this right-hand side, this representation of this dilatation operators in terms of quantum field operators? These generators, Kubar, which I have shown you here, is just differential operator. This is an analog of dilatation operator. It stays there forever. Doesn't matter whether corresponding quantum field operator is modified, its representation at the level of the scattering amplitude is always the same. It doesn't depend on the coupling constant.
Yeah, but I think there's a way to say this question just in, you know, physically. Is it true that symmetry fixes the amplitude or not? It has nothing to do with, it's way too technical.
Physical question is a different one. What does the amplitude? Are the amplitude distributions? What you do is how you define the amplitude. For example, you have seen that the S bar and the amplitude give you delta function. Then you ask the question, do you treat amplitude as a distribution or it's normal function? And then you have answer for the physics. The answer for the physics, the amplitude is not physical quantity. Physical quantity is cross-section. And what's cross-section? This is a modulo square amplitude integrated to the phase space. Therefore, it's not distribution. And this is not distribution. Physical answer, you're not supposed to deform the generators.
Clarification, I guess, is both in both cases the claim is only made for MHV and MMHV. There's no general claim at the tree level. Or are you saying that the general tree level amplitudes for arbitrary helicity configurations are fixed by the? You demonstrated that.
Okay, there is demonstration, there is proof, and there is conjecture. Explicit demonstration was carried out for MHV amplitudes strictly.
Explicit and MMHV. I mean, you showed the example.
NMHV. NMHV.
It was the same thing for Tristan, right?
Well, you can also use the DCFW rules, and then it's something
that goes back. As I mentioned, I was trying to emphasize, if you're playing this BCFW recursion relation, then the question is, I mean, you have a BCFW recursion relation which gives you three-level amplitudes. But then you ask yourself the question, could you show me plates in the BCFW recursion relation which guarantee you dual conformal invariance on the answer? Dual conformal invariance is additional symmetry, right? Before you start turning BCFW recursion relation, you wouldn't see the symmetry. So therefore, there is two lines of thought. So you could start with BCFW recursion relation, turn them up and get the amplitudes, which is nice, or you could use symmetry. The reason why I pointed out the symmetry is because it's not trees that are interested. We want to get loops. And once you go to the loops, it's symmetries which will play a much more important role. So therefore, if I want to get to the loops, you want to first answer the questions, if you see certain symmetries at three level and they get deformed, become anomalous, could you control the anomaly?
Okay, let me just ask two questions, not necessarily only to the speaker. The first is quantum n equals 4 super Young-Mills super conformal theory? And the second one is the scattering amplitude invariant under some conformal symmetry, not necessarily the free conformal symmetry?
You're asking physical question, mathematical question. If you ask physical question, the scattering amplitude in n equal 4 theory equal to zero. Because again, what we're doing here, we're starting from the elastic scattering amplitude. Scattering amplitude is a fixed number of particles. So if you look now for this expression, here it is. So after all the suffering, this becomes a general expression for the amplitude, right? So this becomes the expression. So we know we control some information by finite parts. This becomes the amplitude. Now ask the question, okay, what could I learn about from physics about the amplitude? So what I'm saying, okay, I have epsilon. I put epsilon to zero. Okay? I remove regularization. At the moment I remove regularization, I restore a lot of symmetries in my theory. But now I look here and I have here minus 1/2 epsilon square. So these terms goes away. So the amplitude, elastic amplitude, goes to zero. As a consequence, if you now start talking about physical symmetries of the physical objects, here you're dealing about properties of zero. Okay? So therefore, answer to your question, physically, this object is zero. Now, coming back to second point of the question. So why are we interested about this object? Because at the end of the day, it's not the amplitude that's interesting. We're interested in the physical quantity like cross-section. Okay? The cross-section in general will be given by the quite some number of the amplitude integrated with the final states. If you know that cross-section with physical quantity is free of any singularity, then you should ask questions to be formulated. What would be the symmetries of this physical quantity? So, but at the level of dimensional regularized theories, again, I want to emphasize that the amplitude is zero if you remove regularization. If you don't remove regularization, you're staying at the level of the theory, which defined away from the critical dimension. Therefore, you're not supposed to recover any classical superconformal symmetry.
You should introduce some kinematical restrictions, and they would play the role of regularization exactly. So this cross-section with kinematical restriction are also not, well, there is no conformal symmetry in a sense, right?
There would be conformal symmetry, but in this case, conformal symmetry will act on those kinematical cutoffs that you introduced by hand.
Yes. Okay.
But I want to emphasize one again, that if you want to think about real constraints imposed by the conformal symmetry in your theory, you have to deal with the physical quantity, which is well defined strictly in four dimensions. This is always the problem. There is something which you could calculate, but at the end of the day, you will find that they don't have much.
You use symmetry, yes, and really, I didn't understand. If you impose the same singularities as, you know, these poles which exist in perturbation theory and forbid these fixed poles, and after that we fix amplitude without. But is it possible to include the simultaneous poles in overlapping channel? What forbids you to include such poles? If you include these poles, they contradict your general symmetry.
do not contradict.
The way how the problem was approached. We start from the explicit expression which were provided by the gentleman, and we verify the symmetry. You're asking the question, if I would, for example, let me formulate this question. So imagine I want to solve these equations, the equation for the invariance. Remember that? So your question could be formulated as follows. So imagine I want to solve these equations. So these are system of differential equations. Now I ask the question, is it possible to constrain a general solution to this equation? If it's possible, whether I could identify among all possible solutions those which have your analytical properties. If they exist, such solutions, they may be part of the full answer. It may well happen that such solutions do not exist. Then in this case, I would say that this dual conformal symmetry prohibits of existing function which have singularity in the crossing channel.
Maybe it is need to enforce these conditions somehow. Yes, additional conditions. Yes, at least at loop level, not on three level, of course, it should be fulfilled. No, I wanted to ask, what are relations between invariants in principle? Do they correspond to physical situations? I mean, to the sub-physical invariants which appear in physical picture, or you take Euclidean, for example, all invariants. So, what to impose on this invariants? This amplitude is realized in Minkowski space, or it is realized in Euclidean.
I don't know, maybe since David was responsible for this formula, your answer to this question is in this diagram. So again, this invariant is just abstract expression. It could be defined in any signature. So it could be defined for any signature for any values of the Minkowski variables, time-like, space-like, any. But another question is that it comes from this particular diagram, and this particular diagram becomes part of the calculation of the scattering amplitude. So if you wish, this is just part of the physics. You calculate scattering amplitude with n external gluons, and this becomes part of the final answer.